Here's a sound that many people who grew up in the 1950s, 60s, 70s or 80s hoped they'd never hear, but feared that they ultimately would. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to Future Tense. I can remember as a small child overhearing two adults talking about the threat of nuclear war, and both of them were convinced that it was just a matter of time.
This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba.
Весь мир знает, что самая империалистическая держава – это Соединенные Штаты Америки.
We cannot buy our security, our freedom from the threat of the bomb, by committing an immorality so great as saying to a billion human beings now enslaved behind the Iron Curtain, give up your dreams of freedom, because to save our own skins, we're willing to make a deal with your slave masters.
Until the very end of the Cold War, the threat of nuclear Armageddon was always just below the surface. And then, when the Cold War ended...
Good evening, everyone. From the west side of the Berlin Wall at the Brandenburg Gate, I'm Tom Brokaw. The Brandenburg Gate, of course, is in East Berlin, and the sound that you hear and what you're seeing tonight, not hammers and sickles, but hammers and chisels as young people take down this wall bit by bit. Earlier this evening...
Well, when the Cold War ended, so too, thankfully, did the threat of nuclear war. But of course... that's not the way it really ended up.
There are tens of thousands of warheads around the world, and a couple of arsenals are actually growing larger. China is building its nuclear arsenal. Pakistan is as well, and I suspect the Indians are probably tracking along with Pakistan. So there are places where nuclear weapons are increasing rather than decreasing. We're used to thinking about a bipolar world where there are only two nuclear powers that we worried about to any extent, but now we have more than half a dozen, and I think that's a more dangerous world.
Everyone, including myself, heaved an enormous sigh of relief when the Cold War ended, and we sat down and lay on our couches and said, thank God that's it. And Russia and America would get rid of the nuclear weapons. Currently, Russia and America own 94% of the 16,400 H-bombs in the world. They're the real terrorists threatening life on Earth with extinction, I may say. Both countries are ready to launch if necessary. That situation has not changed.
Long-time anti-nuclear campaigner Helen Caldicott, and before her, Andrew Davies from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. One thing that's become clear when you look at the extent of nuclear weaponry in the world today is that different analysts seem to have different figures. And that's not surprising, given that a country like Israel, for instance, refuses to even officially acknowledge its nuclear weapons status. And then you have a secretive nation like North Korea. So the figures are always going to be best estimates. For the purposes of this program, we'll go with the figures from SIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. According to their 2015 yearbook, released in June, there are currently around 15,850 nuclear weapons in the world, with approximately 1,800 of them kept in a state of high operational alert. Perhaps even more worrying is the fact that all nine nuclear weapons-possessing nations are either upgrading their existing nuclear weapon systems or working to develop new ones, according to SIPRI. Earlier this year, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty's latest round of talks all but collapsed, with analysts warning a new form of international agreement is needed to keep developments in check. So how serious is the risk of a future nuclear conflict? And given international tensions, is any hope of disarmament now completely off the table?
You know, in some sense, the period of the Cold War and of the Second World War were actually in some sense aberrations, probably entering a period that's obviously different from the 19th or 18th centuries, but in some sense has some similarities in that there's likely to be state rivalry that isn't highly ideological necessarily. And I think nuclear weapons are likely to play more and more into that as the geopolitical environment becomes more competitive and as the military environment becomes more competitive. And I think you can see the a good, if sobering, indication of that in Russia's behavior in the last year, where they've been brandishing nuclear weapons as a way to compensate for their own feelings of general conventional inferiority and as a way to kind of spook the West.
Elbridge Colby, a senior fellow with the Center for American Security, who's written extensively on future nuclear hotspots. While he worries about Russia's increased saber-rattling in Europe, Colby sees Northeast Asia and the Western Pacific as the real potential nuclear trouble zone.
I mean, in some sense, particularly over the medium to longer term, this is the real fulcrum of potential conflict. Dick Betts, a very wise professor at Columbia University, points out that Taiwan is the one area where most likely see nuclear escalation, although now I think that's possible in the Baltics, too, to a greater degree. The issue is not that the Chinese in particular are raring to use nuclear weapons, but more that there are a couple of factors pushing in that direction. You know, one is as the military balance between the United States and its allies becomes more competitive with China, which I think we're seeing and unfortunately probably likely to continue to see, that makes what people sometimes call inadvertent escalation more plausible. That is, when the United States really dominated China militarily, if there was a battle over Taiwan, the United States would have kind of been in control. And so nobody really wanted nuclear weapons to get involved unless it was the Chinese. And that was a pretty unpalatable course of action. But if it's a dirtier, nastier, faster fight, if China does obtain or gain conventional military advantage over the U.S. and its allies and partners in the region, the U.S. will want to rely more on nuclear weapons to try to compensate for China's newfound conventional military advantage. And that could be in part because of pressure from allies like Japan and others. And, finally, if the United States doesn't want to go in that direction and China does gain the conventional military advantage, that there's real proliferation pressures that could arise. Other countries in the region might seek to, obtain nuclear weapons of their own to compensate for China's military power. And, of course, there's also the North Korea, which is sort of a wild card, a wild card plus, if you will, unfortunately, which is going after nuclear weapons, going after increasingly long-range and sophisticated delivery systems. And so I think, there are a number of factors whereby, military issues more broadly, I think we see pretty clearly, but also nuclear weapons could become more salient unless trends really change.
Elbridge Colby. It's worth noting that in the past few weeks alone, China has staged one of its largest ever military parades. And Japan's defense ministry has asked its government for yet another substantial increase in military spending, its fourth in as many years. If granted, the 2016 Japanese defense budget will be its biggest ever.
With a more competitive geopolitical environment, and particularly with a rising China that's increasingly feeling its oats, increasingly bumptious, countries like South Korea and Japan and to some extent other, of course, Australia and others, will have a choice fundamentally, which is the classic sort of, do you balance against this rising China and try to contain it, or, contain is a dirty word, but try to balance it and try to constrain it, or do you kind of go along and try to make the best of the situation? I think countries are going to have an incentive to at least want to try to balance, to try to kind of keep their own interests protected, Japan being a classic example, particularly because the United States is a security guarantor and a security ally partner. The issue is, if China is able to obtain conventional military dominance in the region, which means that it can fight and win a conventional war against the United States and its allies in the Western Pacific, or over interests that these countries care about, if you're Japan, say the Ryukyu Islands or the East China Sea Islands, basically, you're in a situation where China can, has what you might call escalation advantage. They basically could say, hey, if you don't do what we want, we go to war, we win. And in that case, Japan might say, or other countries might say, hey, Washington, we expect you, as you did in the Cold War, to kind of live up to your alliance commitment by relying more on nuclear weapons. In that case, Washington can say, yeah, we'll do that. Or Washington might say, we're not really so interested. In that eventuality, I think in particular, you're going to see a lot of the middle powers say, well, it's no longer sensible to outsource our, liaise or ally with the United States as a method of protecting our security and our interests, and can't match China, bullet for bullet, man for man. So nuclear weapons are, the great equalizer. So I think that's where the dynamic could go. you know, this is one of the things, one of the reasons why I think it's important for the U.S. and its allies to really try to maintain the conventional military edge. I think the United States has made its fair share of mistakes and doesn't need to be going around and, you know, bashing everybody's head in. But I do think that having the advantage in the Pacific militarily is actually a stabilizing force, you know, for countries like Australia, Japan, South Korea, et cetera. I also think there's a message in there for Beijing, which is, you know, be careful what you wish for.
Meaning, if China starts throwing its military weight around, it shouldn't be surprised if others begin beefing up their arsenals against it. Elbridge Colby from the Center for American Security.
Now, the big story at this hour, there's no end to the ceasefire violations by Pakistan. Guns continue to blaze along the international border, forcing thousands of people to flee their...
Another likely future nuclear hotspot is South Asia.
The sense I got is that people here are very scared, very worried. And I came here to understand what they're going through, what they're feeling. And I got a...
In recent weeks, India and Pakistan have been at it again, exchanging artillery fire across their border. You probably weren't aware of the renewed shelling because it got very little media coverage. It happened so often. And according to Ramesh Taka from the Australian National University's Centre for Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament, it's that simmering tension that makes the region potentially explosive.
There is not one example since 1945 of any country that wanted to attack and invade another country but was stopped from doing so primarily or only because that other country had nuclear weapons. There's not a single example of that, nor is there any example, not one, of a country succeeding in coercing another country with the threat of using nuclear weapons. What it does do is add an extra element of caution. Yes, if there is another terrorist-style attack in India that India believes has come from Pakistan, the fact that Pakistan has nuclear weapons complicates the Indian response. But it doesn't guarantee no military response, and it does add to the dangers of terrorists getting their hands on weapons, of someone deciding we are going to authorize the use of this or we are going to use it, whether or not the government gives us permission. It requires Pakistan to develop battlefield nuclear weapons, which means pre-delegated authority to low-level military commanders. When these weapons are so destructive, they should only be decided on by the president and the military chiefs. So there's all these different risks and uncertainties and dangers which today are much more significant. And the prospects of nuclear weapons use, by the way, have grown because of their proliferation to countries in more volatile and unstable regions. No one can be confident that there will not be another terrorist attack along the lines of Mumbai some years ago. If that happens, I think the chances are high rather than low that next time around the Indian government will authorize limited military retaliation. Can that remain limited or will it escalate to a war? If it escalates to a war, does it cross the nuclear threshold? No one can be confident that won't happen.
I worry less about Iran than I worry about Pakistan in that part of the world, because Pakistan is an established nuclear power and there are certain elements within the Pakistani state apparatus who have more sympathy for extremist groups than perhaps the rest of us would be comfortable with. I know that Hugh White has made the observation that if a nuclear weapon explodes in a Western city, the most likely place it will have come from will be Pakistan, and I think I'd agree with that assessment.
Andrew Davies from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute.
The security of nuclear weapons in any state where governance is an issue is something we certainly should be worrying about. And I'd put Pakistan at the head of the list. As long as Pakistani nuclear weapons stay under the command and control of the military, I think we're relatively safe. But if Pakistan's state apparatus becomes even less functional than it is at the moment, and there's a significant breakdown of the arrangements to secure nuclear weapons in Pakistan, I think that would be a really alarming development. As far as Russia's concerned, the worry there is that Russia is a state that's declining in many ways, and declining states are often more dangerous than states that are on the upswing. And we've seen a lot of Russian aggressiveness and assertiveness in the Ukraine, and that there's a worry that could spread to the Baltic states. And coupled with that is the fact that Russian military doctrine has always involved a fairly rapid escalation to tactical level nuclear weapons. That was certainly Russian doctrine throughout the Cold War when the two sides faced off against the border in Germany. So I think that's another place that we should be looking pretty carefully.
Given that the situation is so precarious in various parts of the world, there are potential flashpoints there, and there's certainly increased political and military tensions. As societies, why are we so unconcerned or seemingly so lacking in concern?
Well, I think there's an element of complacency about it. The Cold War was one experiment in nuclear balance, and the fact that we happened to weather it safely perhaps gives a false sense of confidence that that will always be the case. You know, the Cold War seemed pretty grim, but it all turned out okay. So I do worry that perhaps the wrong lessons have been taken from that. And it's not obvious to me, at least, that the reluctance to use nuclear weapons that characterised much of the Cold War actually pertains to the modern world.
You know, we often think, when we think of nuclear conflict, if indeed we do, we think about the humanitarian toll, we think about the military toll and the politics of it all. What about the economics, though? What would the use of a nuclear weapon, even in a limited conflict, what would that do for the world's economy, do you think?
Well, I think the world economy is not in a happy place at the moment, and I don't think you'd have to get to a nuclear war in order for there to be a very significant impact on the world economy. I think any sort of a conflict between Japan, China and the United States, or any combination of those countries, would cause a severe disruption to the world economy, and I think the world would very quickly fall into recession. Any use of nuclear weapons, I think, would be the same, but more so.
One of the risks that's talked about, and I know earlier this year there were some suggestions that ISIS had acquired enough nuclear material to make what's called a dirty bomb, or radiological dispersal device. How seriously do you take those kind of threats of some form of non-state actor using a dirty bomb? Should we be concerned about that?
Well, I think there's a possibility of that happening, if for no other reason than the psychological impact of it would be very high. If you take a cold, hard, analytic look at the impact of dirty bombs and distributing radiological material, they're unlikely to be mass casualty events, certainly nothing on the scale of a nuclear explosion. And the impact is more likely to be one of propaganda and psychology, but because of the way that people worry about radiation, I think that would still be substantial.
So the consensus from our guests today is that the world is perhaps more at risk than ever from the use of nuclear weapons. You're listening to Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell.
Madam President, we have made clear throughout the process that we will not accept the efforts by some to cynically manipulate the RevCon or try and leverage the negotiation to advance their narrow objectives at the expense of the treaty.
I want to begin by reading a portion of the message that President Obama has sent for this occasion. He says, "For over 45 years, the NPT has embodied our shared vision of a world without nuclear weapons."
Madam President, Egypt is extremely disappointed at the end of this conference. And after 1 month of diligent work by all delegations, and after great world expectations, we are blocked from strengthening the NPT and the goal of a world free of nuclear weapons.
The collapse of the latest round of nuclear non-proliferation treaty negotiations in May this year was enormously significant. But once again, it got very little international media coverage. The NPT negotiations are important, says the ANU's Ramesh Thakur, because for decades the treaty has been the main way in which some form of control has been kept on the growth of the world's nuclear weapons programs. Still, he wasn't surprised when they ended in failure.
It tends to go in cycles. Sometimes it's been successful, sometimes not. The last one was success, before that was not. But the biggest reason why it was not a surprise was that the atmosphere between Russia and the United States, including on nuclear issues, has become very, very tense following the Ukraine crisis. And the distance between those who have nuclear weapons and others who want to get rid of them has increased over the past 2 to 3 years. Plus the difficulties in the Middle East and the calls for a Middle East nuclear weapon-free zone that were always going to be risked as deal breakers, and that's what happened.
You've made the point that the NPT, as it's called, has had some successes in the past in curbing the proliferation of nuclear weapons. But you wrote recently that you believe that the treaty may well now, because of those tensions, have reached the limit of its potential and exhausted its normative capacity. Just explain that a bit more to us.
Well, the NPT was negotiated and signed in 1968 and came into operation in 1970. It's been a remarkably successful as well as a near universal treaty. When it was signed, we feared that by the 1980s or 90s, we might have 20 countries or more with nuclear weapons. In fact, we are still in single figures, if only just with 9 countries altogether. It's also been successful in underwriting the transfer of nuclear materials and technology with safety assurances and with safeguards so that they're not diverted to weapons use. It hasn't been so successful, in overseeing dismantlement of the nuclear weapons of those who have these bombs. So not one of the countries that had it in 68, not one of them has given it up. We have 4 more countries, and there's no sign when you look at the arsenals, the deployment practices, the modernization and upgrades already underway, that any of these 9 contemplates giving it up. That has produced increasing frustrations, and there's a movement called the Humanitarian Impacts Movement, which is the main game in town as far as the non-nuclear weapon states are concerned in terms of seeking continued dramatic reductions and an eventual denuclearization of the entire world. So both with regard to the older nuclear powers and the new ones, the NPT is no longer capable of ensuring continued and total disarmament. That poses a problem for us, because the security gains and the political gains of the NPT have been very real. But the policy challenge becomes, how do we protect and preserve these gains and benefits, but still work around the NPT with respect to further progress in freeing the world of the existence and the threat and use of nuclear weapons?
And how do you do that? Because, I mean, you've also written that more and more countries have become cynical about the way in which the NPT has been used by the existing nuclear powers and feel that they're using devices like the NPT to frustrate the disarmament process. So how do you move forward from this point?
Well, when sufficient numbers of countries become convinced that that is in fact the real motivation to frustrate and impede rather than to use the treaty to facilitate and achieve these objectives, then they'll work outside it. And we have examples. For example, the Ottawa Convention on Anti-Personnel Landmines gave up on the conference on disarmament and said, we'll convene a conference in Ottawa. Those who are interested, come and sign. That treaty was adopted. The countries that were the major producers at the time didn't sign on, and yet that treaty has had remarkably successful and normative impact in actually overseeing the destruction and dismantlement of many stockpiles of landmines and inhibiting the production and use of landmines even by others. So with that in mind, there's 3 things that can be done. And to that end, the General Assembly last year adopted a resolution which most of the countries signed on to, calling for the stigmatization, a prohibition and elimination of nuclear weapons. So countries could get together and decide that they will convene a conference with a view to banning the use of nuclear weapons. Those countries that want to come and attend and sign do so, others don't. We don't expect any of the countries with nuclear weapons to come and attend this. But it adds to the very significant existing normative prohibition on the use of nuclear weapons, if adopted, and if adopted by overwhelming majority. Let's say 150 countries sign on. That's pretty significant, and it's very hard to ignore the normative force of that. So if you take the argument that the NPT's normative capacity has been exhausted, where do we find new basis for this normative authority? This is one way. We can then add to that by saying we'll ban not only the use, but we will go further and ban the possession of nuclear weapons. So I think the frustration comes from this, that the world is in a dangerous place. The risks and dangers of nuclear weapons, whether by design or accident or rogue launch, are still very real. There's not sufficient progress being achieved and demonstrated by those who have nuclear weapons to reduce and eliminate the risks. Therefore, let's work around them and increase the normative barriers for their possession and use.
Well, I think what we're seeing is some aspects of the original non-proliferation treaty coming home to roost. And that was what's called the third pillar of the treaty, and that is that countries have access to all elements of peaceful use of nuclear power. And at the time, there was a relatively few number of countries that fit that criteria. But when it's all said and done, we've got to remember that the ability to produce nuclear weapons requires the level of technical and scientific sophistication that the United States had in 1942, when it instigated the Manhattan Project. So what we've seen, and I think the Iran case is a good example of that, is that that particular element of the treaty enables countries to reach a very high degree of what's called nuclear latency, and that is they're not explicitly nuclear powers, but they have the ability to become one relatively quickly. And I think that's one of the very difficult things to manage with the NPT. But ultimately, the reason that the current round of talks has broken down is that there's no shared consensus and there's no great will to make it happen.
So where do you go from here, given that the world is increasingly, or it seems to be, increasingly at odds with itself over politics and over military might?
Well, I think the best that you can do in lieu of a universal treaty, and we must remember that the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty has actually been remarkably successful. And I think that we're more likely to see the sort of thing that we've just seen with Iran, where on a case-by-case basis deals are hammered out.
So you don't have any faith in some sort of universal treaty? I know that there are people who feel that that is the way in which the world should be heading, but you don't think that's possible?
Oh, I think it's the way the world should be heading. I think that would be absolutely preferable to anything else. But I think there are some players in the world at the moment, notably the Russians, who just aren't interested in codifying a set of universal rules. The next 10 years, I don't think, is a critical period. It's always a little bit hard to tell, but I think the Iran problem has probably been put on the back burner for 5 to 10 years. North Korea will remain a wild card. Otherwise, I think we'll see a continuation of existing trends. I think the real danger is probably in 20 years' time, when a lot of the strategic and demographic and economic pressures we're seeing build at the moment play out.
Mr. President, when the United States was the sole possessor of nuclear weapons, we felt that even one nuclear power was one too many. Beginning with the Baruch Plan in 1946, we have persisted in our efforts to curb the spread of nuclear weapons. This treaty is not the work of any one country.
The American assessment of the strategic situation and the nuclear landscape is in transition at the moment. I think there was a very deep peace dividend that followed at the end of the Cold War, where the thinking was that America had become an unchallenged superpower, and I think there was a sort of winding down of American thinking about its need to have both conventional and nuclear force that it could exert at any time. I think what we're seeing now is a recalibration of that peace dividend and a slow realisation that, no, there are real challenges out there. One of the big problems for the Americans is managing the budget at the moment, because you can't modernise and add technical sophistication to your conventional and nuclear forces without spending some money. And because of the budget sequestration problems and the problems getting military budgets through the US Congress, the interesting thing will be whether the American polity actually has the wherewithal to respond to the challenge that it's now starting to see.
Andrew Davies from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. And now an end note to today's program on the future of nuclear weapons. It's worth remembering that the most powerful members of the United Nations are the five permanent members of the UN Security Council: the United States, Russia, France, Britain, and China. They each have the power of veto over Council decisions, and all five of them have a nuclear arsenal. We also heard today from Ramesh Tucker at the ANU, Helen Caldicott from the Helen Caldicott Foundation for a Nuclear-Free Planet, and Elbridge Colby from the Centre for American Security. Thanks to my co-producer, Karin Zsivanovits, and sound engineer, Steve Fieldhouse. I'm Anthony Fennell. You've been listening to Future Tense. Until next time, cheers.
Hi there, Sarah Kanoski here. Now, Books and Arts came to you live from the Brisbane Writers' Festival. We heard Laurie Penny on modern feminism, took a look at what drugs really do to your brain, considered the new generation of male writers sharing some very personal stories, and took a look at the hidden relationship between crime and mateship. If you missed it, you can podcast the program anytime from Books and Arts at the RN homepage.